Hey, welcome back, everybody. It's time once again for Closing the Wealth Gap. The one show, maybe the only show, that shows you how to close the wealth gap in your own life with the man who's done it for many, our wealth coach himself, Tyrone French. Hey, Tyrone.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Closing the Wealth Gap. I'm your host, Tyrone French. I want to thank everybody for tuning in today. And also, if you think this content is relevant, what we'd like for you to do is go to closingthewealthgap.net and hit that follow button. It would really help us out. Also, if you want to reach out to me and speak with me directly, email, Zoom, just give me a call. I want you to download my free mobile app. It is absolutely free. I think I priced it to where everybody could afford it. Just go to TyroneFrench.coach. That's TyroneFrench.coach. Put it in your phone. Click on the icon, and you have direct contact with me 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Also, just wanted people to know that this episode is brought to you by Long Beach BMW. I want you to go to longbeachbmw.com. Go to the service department. They've taken care of me and my vehicle for years. They'll do the same for you. The general manager over there is Robert Lee. He's a great guy. That being said, we're going to talk about today's episode, which is closing the racial wealth gap. And a lot of people are talking about shrinkflation these days and how, you know, companies are gouging. They're talking about how they're getting less value for their buck. But we really never really look at the long-term effects, and we're looking at closing the racial wealth gap, because again, as things become more affordable or more unaffordable, that wealth gap is getting larger and larger and wider and wider. And today I have two distinguished guests. As a matter of fact, they're brothers and sisters, and they're from the RAND Corporation. Now, if you've never heard of the RAND Corporation, it is a major think tank as far as researching probability schedules, analysis. And we're fortunate to have two professors from the RAND Corporation. So we got Jonathan W. Wellburn, and we have Jessica Wellburn Page. Thank you for being on the show. And starting with Jessica. Jessica, you got my attention because I was going to the RAND website, and I do a lot of research, and I saw that you had a particular article on closing the wealth gap, closing the racial wealth gap, and then that's when I found Jonathan. So first and foremost, Jessica, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And Jonathan, welcome to the show as well.
Thank you so much.
So, What was the motivation of actually starting out with, first of all, explain, what is the RAND Corporation? What do they do? Jessica.
Well, the RAND Corporation is a policy think tank, and we do research on a wide range of issues, including inequality in the labor market, inequality in education. We do research on different issues pertaining to national security, homeland security. We cover a wide range of topics, and our research is policy focused, solution based. We work really hard to objectively think about research problems, put together the best, most skilled research teams to solve those problems. We've got researchers from a range of disciplines here at RAND, and work with folks from all different spaces, government, nonprofits, other spaces to solve pressing social issues.
Well, great. And also, Jonathan, who was it? I mean, you guys are brothers and sisters, but who was it that actually started out at the RAND Corporation first? Was it you, or was it Jessica?
So I started out here first. I've been at RAND for about 7 years. I was in our Pittsburgh office first. We have a couple different office locations, but now I'm in our headquarters in Santa Monica, and Jessica joined us more recently in D.C.
Okay. Now, also, as far as your qualifications and background, I see that you have a Ph.D. from University of Wisconsin.
That's right.
And Jessica, you have a MA in sociology from Harvard University?
Yes, and I got my PhD there as well.
Yes. So would you mind, do I call you doctor or should I call you professor?
You could just call me Jessica. I'm fine.
Okay. Okay. And Jonathan, same question. Doctor or professor?
I think John is fine.
Okay, great. And so John, I saw that you had a couple of articles and you specifically talked about closing the wealth gap. Now, there's a blog and you guys actually presented studies. My question is, now that we understand what the RAND Corporation is, because again, to a lot of my audience, the listeners, this is their first time hearing about RAND. So now that we know this, a research organization, it's a think tank. Jonathan, why is RAND interested in closing the wealth gap?
I think that's great. A lot of people might want to do the same thing. You know, we ran, so we recently, we ran, we are now just RAND. We are not RAND, no longer the RAND Corporation, just RAND.
Yes.
And so as RAND, you know, our past CEO, Michael Rich, used to articulate something called the RAND idea quite a lot. And I think that it kind of explains this, because the way he would talk about it was that, you know, RAND's real purpose was to bring the best possible evidence that's free of ideology or free of partisanship to the country or even the world's most important decisions, that those things that impact the most people and require the most resources to actually solve. And I really like the way that he's articulated that, because I think it answers your question. When we're thinking about the racial wealth gap, it's exactly that type of problem. It affects a lot of people. It is a longstanding problem. It really is a challenge that can benefit from this approach where it's nonpartisan, it's objective, data driven, and trying to bring that best evidence to, which is actually a pretty wide range of decision makers.
Yes. You know, and also, Jessica, based on your article, as far as, and you're really focusing in on closing that racial wealth gap. To me, I think it's a national security issue, that wealth gap is getting wider and wider and wider. And in reading your article, a lot of people don't know how we got here. And so just based on your research, and you know, we're going to talk about, probably run about 45 minutes today, and we're going to touch on a few topics. But in your opinion, based on the wealth gap, the racial wealth gap, what are some of the issues? What are some of the factors that got us to this point? Because it just didn't happen overnight.
No. You know, so I think that's a great question. And I think it's really important to begin with the history of the United States. And the United States as a country did not really start to give African Americans full rights until the mid-20th century, and even that's sort of disputable. And so what that means is that the country was never structured for African Americans or other people of color to be able to live full lives, let alone build wealth.
Yes.
So it wasn't, you know, until the mid-20th century that there were actually steps taken to ensure that African Americans had opportunities to live and work and go to school in spaces that allowed them to achieve upward mobility. Before that, we were in a situation where systemic racism prevented African Americans from taking advantage of many of the opportunities that whites have been able to in the United States. And so what that means is that there are simply mechanisms in place that prevented African Americans from being able to do things that whites have done to build wealth, the most basic being buying home.
Yes.
Other things include high-paying jobs or investments. All those things, African Americans and other people of color, Latinos, Asians, have been systematically excluded from doing. And that begins again with the beginning of the United States.
You know, also, based on the conversation we're going to have today and the topic that we're having today, there's going to be, and I can hear it, oh, you know, that was a long time ago. You guys need to get over it. You know, we have all these opportunities now. Why do you guys keep bringing this up? But if you don't understand the history of something, if you don't understand the causality of why we're here. A lot of times, just based on ignorance, people are going to reply based on they just don't know. They don't understand why this is such an issue. And again, one of the reasons why we break this we break this topic down by race, because if you look at the other entities, whether it's the Brookings Institute, whether it's Pew Research, even whether it's the Bureau of Labor and Statistics, they break this stuff down in ethnicity. They break it down in white. They break it down Black, Asians, Latinos. So if you're listening to this show right now and you're offended based on we're talking about African Americans or we're talking about race, when you look at this problem, you look at this study, it has to be broken down in race or by race. So you mentioned one thing about even with the housing and the real estate. Can you explain redlining? Because people may have heard that term, but they don't necessarily understand what redlining, what it was, what it did, and how it's actually impacting people of color today. Jessica.
Yeah, can I take it back a little bit for a second?
Okay.
One thing I wanted to point out for folks who may be struggling with making sense of this history is that African Americans lost out on trillions of dollars just during slavery.
So yes.
If we just start there, I yes. think that's important, something that people have lost sight of.
Yes.
You know, that alone would be trillions of dollars for African Americans. So that's why it's so important.
Yeah, even 40 acres and a mule. We never got that. Even with the Freedmen's Bank, when people started putting their money after the Civil War, they were told, hey, look, you have this institution that you can literally save money. And the Freedmen's Bank went belly up. And they lost all of their money. Then they started passing vagrancy laws, whereas if you weren't gainfully employed, you could literally go to jail. So when you look at even fast forward today, there's a lot of people, a lot of African-Americans that don't really want to put their money in the bank. And they don't know where that come from. Where does that stigma come from? But you have a lot of people that are unbanked because they don't trust those institutions. They don't trust them.
It's very important. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, you know, we think about in our own family, I mean, our grandparents knew people who were enslaved. So it was not that long ago.
No, it wasn't.
That this happened. And I think people want to sort of say, well, that was, you know, hundreds of years ago. Really, you know, we're only a few generations out. So that's where I think it's always important to begin. But we can get back to the redlining question. Who wants to take that?
Well, you know, it does pick up, right? So from there, this is where you get into to redlining, other types of exclusion in housing. So that you know, there's several ways in which that's happened throughout history. So, you know, redlining is you know, denying people access to housing in certain neighborhoods, denying people access to loans to buy those housing. And so part of the I guess we're all probably agreeing, but just to state this out loud, that housing is one of the largest portions of wealth in America and is itself associated with a large share of the gap between wealth, between white and Black households. And so when it comes to not having access to low interest loans, not having access to these nice terms that many white households have had, redlining kind of prevented Black households from having access. There's other things too. There was, you know, differences in, you know, the people like our grandfather who fought in World War II, that there was differences in access to the GI Bill and buying housing, right? So there was exactly. A lot in the middle of the 20th century. But I would argue that, and part of this comes from reading great books like Richard Rothstein's Color of Law, that there are that difference in access, the redlining, the racial covenants in housing, which said you should not sell your home to a Black household, to I think there were requirements in the National Association of Realtors to not sell homes. That extended to recent history. You know, extended to the late 80s. I mean, even the Fair Housing Act, I suppose, was supposed to solve some of these in the late 60s, but, you know, a lot of these practices extended to the late 80s.
Right.
So when it comes to different access to one of the best wealth instruments of housing, you know, a lot of us have been alive during periods where that there has been differences in access that has been supported by government in some form.
Right. And so, John, I want you to elaborate, though. Why would it be so important to own a home, even when you look at as far as inheritance, or if you're looking at access to capital or lines of credit? Why is it so important to have that designation as a homeowner? Why is that so important as far as the wealth gap and closing?
I think one of the reasons why people look at housing as this way of building wealth is that it's an investment. There's many investments that we get in life, but that one is a leveraged investment where you get to, you know, borrow at, you know, historically often at pretty low interest rates. I mean, that's changed a little bit right now, but especially looking in the past, that people get to borrow at pretty low interest rates. They get tax relief for, yes, for buying homes. There's a lot of incentives that make that investment special. And it's an asset that people get to, then you're right. That's an asset that you can then borrow against as well. So that's capital that you can use if you are trying to start a small business or something like that.
Yes.
So you get to borrow against. So that's an asset that leads itself to other opportunities. And one thing, because again, for some people in the audience, they might not realize how much today is tied to the past. So just to give a really simple example of housing, let's just imagine that, you know, our grandfather had access to low interest rate homes and was able to buy this house in a nice neighborhood. And that house is, you know, by the time he died, the house is worth a fair amount of money. That then, you know, he has two children, and then those two children have two children. Let's just say for math, there's like five of us, because that would be around average. There's actually four, but just for the averages.
Yes.
Then when they sell that house, after grandparents pass away, that is an asset that gets to be passed on to generations. And just for the convenience of math again, you sell that house, you break it up into five parts, you get 20% of the value. If then when the grandchildren want to go buy a house and you need to put 20% down, you've got that 20%. That 20% was just passed down from, you know, an asset that was purchased a generation ago.
Yes.
Is now the investment that we now get to leverage against to build wealth in our own home.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
This is a hypothetical because it's something that, you know, we didn't have, and lots of Black Americans didn't have.
Yeah. You know, but I look at it as a generational wealth coach. It not only is it an asset, but it just, let's say if they decided they didn't want to sell the property, but they wanted to keep it in the family. Now you have an income producing asset that you can collateralize. And also you can actually place that property inside of a trust. And so now you have the family has its own trust, which is actually can equate to its own family bank. That now because you have this asset that you can actually borrow from, now, even if you don't have the 20% from a down payment that you maybe scraped and tried to save, you can literally use that asset to start a business, to create revenue. And now, just like any other bank, if it's controlled by the family can set the terms of the loan. Now, they can do the same thing as far as a credit search. They can create a promissory note, however way they want to do it. But again, you can make this transaction the same way that you can do it with a bank and have collateral or secure it with income or, you know, just good faith of that person. But again, what you're doing is you have access to capital to where it's now you can buy the home. You can start the business. You have the money to go to college. So again, we were locked out of those things. And even when you look at today, just based on going back to the past and looking at today and the appraisal values of certain properties, meaning that let's say because ghettos didn't just pop up per se. The hood just didn't pop up per se. It was orchestrated. It's organized. And so even today, when you look at real estate prices and appraisals, even today, just living in a black neighborhood versus a white neighborhood, your property is going to appraise the appraisal rate is going to be lower. So, Jessica, can you elaborate just based on just the redlining, the real estate appraisal cost, why it's important to as far as net worth? Because when you break down these studies, a lot of the studies are looking at net worth, meaning that they'll say, well, white people have a higher net worth than black people. Latinos have a higher net worth than Asians. Latinos have a higher net worth than black. Asians have a higher net worth than black. It seems like when you look at that study, black people are always at the low end of the totem pole when you're talking about net worth. But explain to me why and how that factored in based on that net worth calculation.
Yeah, so for most Americans, a good amount of their net worth is in their home. And so I'm just going to look at the 2022 data from the Federal Reserve Bank.
Yes.
And you've got the median net worth for African Americans around $44,000. For Latinos, it was around $62,000. And for white households, it was around $285,000.
Wow.
So that's a huge gap. And for a good amount of people, their net worth is in their home if they have a home. So having a home, particularly in an area that is stable, can help to close that gap. Now, I should say home ownership is not a panacea. It's not a
exactly
solution.
Exactly.
Because homes, as you were saying, there are a lot of issues with neighborhood segregation and appraisals. And so homes that Blacks and Latinos work our own tend to be worth less than homes that whites own, and oftentimes the gap is huge. And
yes.
So it doesn't mean it's a solution, but it is a contributor to that issue of net worth.
Exactly, exactly. And you know, and again, we're not pointing the fingers based on white, black, Latino, Asian. What we're doing is we're breaking down the study based on what the numbers are and the categories that they're in. So if you're offended by this number, if you're offended by this category, you know, made me kind of look inward and ask yourself, why would I be offended by this study and be offended by the numbers and breaking it down in race? Because on this show, we tend to reference the Federal Reserve Bank a lot of times as far as that the consumer study or the consumer survey. And all of the numbers are right there at the Federal Reserve. Anybody can go to the website and get these studies and look at these numbers. So like you were saying, as far as real estate is not a panacea, for me, you know, the American dream is business ownership. Because, you know, if you own a business and you're generating income from that business, now you can't be fired. Now you can't be laid off. You know, a lot of times it's, you know, African-Americans are the last hired and the first fired. And what you do is, you know, you go out there and now you feel a certain amount of security and you go, you buy the car, you know, you buy the home, you take out the credit cards. But a lot of times, if you only have that one source of income and all of a sudden you lose that income, now you can't make the mortgage payment on time. You can't make the car payment on time. You can't make the credit card payment on time. So then what does that do to your credit report? What does that do to your credit score? It lowers it. And the way things are tied in today, based on that score alone, that could actually prevent you from getting a job. So a lot of times now you lost that job, you lost that high paying job because you had that one income source. And now you're back in the job market trying to get gainful employment. But now you got all these things working against you. And the biggest ones, like I said, is with your credit score. But how do you resolve that? If you had a source, a revenue source, a reserve that you could tap into during those times of feast or famine, during those times of you were making had the good job, the high paying job, you had the great income, but now all of a sudden you're in this time where you're in the famine. But while you were in that feast, you were able to put away maybe 3 months of your income, 6 months of your income. or you had another revenue stream that you could tap into until you found that job. So now, you know, you're not in that no man's land, to whereas you're constantly moving forward three steps, but then you're being knocked back 15 steps. And I see that a lot in just in the African-American community, because we don't prepare as well as other ethnic groups because we don't have the same access to capital. And so, John, can you elaborate on what I just said as far as the, you know, taking three steps forward and 15 steps back, because we haven't done the necessary planning and organization for that feast or for that famine cycle? I mean, how does that contribute to the wealth gap?
You know, one of the things that I was thinking about, Tyrone, when you were talking about this, is, and you mentioned this early, was that there's different parts of, there's probably a couple different problems that we're having. So when we think about the wealth gap, one of them is that there was a decent share of, and a disproportionate share of Black Americans who have very low levels of wealth, you know, wealth levels around near zero.
Yes.
And for that population, I think there's a trap. There's a trap when you get down to that level, because it becomes very hard to do some of the things you were talking about. And one of the reasons is that there's a decent share of the of Black and Hispanic communities which don't have regular access to the traditional financial system through banking.
Yes.
There's a lot of underbanked households.
Yes.
And that's, again, you can, I like that you were citing the Fed. You can look, you know, FDIC collects data on this. So there are those objective sources of data on that population. And for folks who are in that space, that just daily life has a lot of transaction costs, that there's cost for checking, for cashing checks.
Yes.
From your employers. There's cost for sending money.
Yes.
There's, you know, people are often in problems where they're using reloadable prepaid cards, and there's constant fees.
Yes.
So there's constant fees for financial transactions. So if you're paying, you know, 10% on fees, that's, you know, that's 10% you're not saving.
Absolutely.
Right? So there's a trap there for a lot of people. And, you know, one of the, you know, being policy folks, so one of the policy problems there is addressing that.
And yes,
that, you know, addressing that is both a problem of, as you mentioned very well, trust and solving the trust problem with banks, and is also a problem of addressing some of the fees that banks charge low wealth customers, low income.
Absolutely. And, you know, I look at that fee. I mean, we call it a fee, but I consider it a tax.
It's a tax.
It's a hidden tax. Just like inflation. Yeah. Inflation to me is a hidden tax. And it's a tax that is so ominous. Again, you don't see it. You don't recognize it, but you question, where is my money going? Where, because it's like having a hammer and chisel. It just, you know, it just whittles down. It just whittles down and whittles down. And you got this whole pile of dollars, or, you know, dimes and $10 here and $5 there. And that pile adds up. The thing is, it's not adding up in your account. It's adding up in somebody else's account. And you don't see it. You don't see it. So the reason this is important to me is because, I should say one of the reasons, read this study that, and again, Jessica, this is going to be a question for you. In 2054, it's projecting, going back to net worth, that the African-American community net worth is going to be zero. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, I haven't seen those projections, but I will say that at the rate we're going, we're not going to close the racial wealth gap by that period of time. And in fact, it's still growing. And so even as African Americans actually have made some gains and been able to increase net worth on average over the past couple of years, actually, because the gap is so large and because white wealth also grows, we just keep seeing this growing gap. And I do think without serious federal intervention, it will continue to grow.
I'm glad that you said that.
Certainly not going to close.
I'm glad that you said that, because what type of federal intervention are you talking about as far? Because we talk about reparations. And that's that triggers a lot of people when they hear that word reparations. But when I think of the term reparations and I think about the wealth that was accumulated, that was stolen from our communities, to me, it's a redress and it's a way of making things whole. But when I looked at your study and I saw the numbers that you were putting out there, just to put a dent in, not to make the racial wealth gap go away, but just to put a dent in the problem, I was shocked. So can you elaborate on that as far as what can the government do to try to solve this problem? And what is the dollar amount that it would take to realistically close that gap?
One of the things that when Jessica was just talking about it, I was thinking that when you look back at the data, that data that we talked about earlier from the U.S. Federal Reserve, the Survey of Consumer Finances, they've been conducting that since 1989.
Yes.
And the wealth gap, the difference in wealth between white and black households has increased throughout the whole time period, with the exception of really two periods. And those two were following the large drop in 1989, the stock market crash,
yes,
as well as in 2008. So really the only times where this happened is during a large stock market loss, because white households hold disproportionate amounts of these assets, appreciable assets,
yes,
they lost more wealth. However, with each recovery, the wealth gap just came right back with it. So recovery in the stock market, it's always been a recovery in the wealth gap. So that was just one point that it really has been increasing over time. But you're right. So Tyrone, we looked at this and we considered a potential change, where a policy change which could basically transfer wealth to black households. And be careful with that word transfer for a second, because we
yes.
don't mean transfer from white to black households. We really mean a allocation to black households. And
read my mind. You read my mind, but go ahead.
So an allocation to black households. And the way that we were, and I can go into detail about that if you want, but of how that works. But the what we were saying was that you can make progress with, through this type of policy. That if we looked at something that was around $500 billion, $500 billion, and that was fairly targeted, you could make a good dent in the wealth, in overall wealth disparity. Now, if you really want to focus on this, though, and think about wealth allocations across all households, so that's the reparation story. This is compensating all black households. That a $1.5 trillion total program that's allocating households to individual black households would cut disparity at the median by about half. That it would take to eliminate disparity at the median, it would take $3 trillion. It's about $168,000
wow.
per household when we did that. That number's increased because the wealth gap keeps increasing.
Yes.
The longer we wait, this number keeps increasing.
Yes.
But if you were really to fully address disparity across the entire distribution, we had done some modeling about this to think about how much you need to address across the distribution, where that wealth gap that's on the low end for so the wealth gap, actually kind of increases as you go from the low end and, poor households to very wealthy households. The wealth gap for wealthy households is very high. The difference between wealthy black households and wealthy white households is extraordinarily high.
Yes.
So if you want to eliminate this across the distribution, it takes about $7.5 trillion to half it and $15 trillion to eliminate it was kind of the numbers. And that's really in a static sense.
It is.
When we look at this, more closely, even if you did that, you would have to also address some of the ongoing factors which are contributing to this racial wealth gap continuing and growing over time. So you don't have it's not just that allocation. You have to do other things. They're constantly chipping away those taxes on Blackwell.
So what would that look like? Whether it was $3 trillion or $5 trillion or $7.5 trillion, what would that look like based on getting those funds to the African American community? Would it be social programs? Would it be a check? What would it look like?
We consider this in the simplest form, which was a check, and that check could be distributed over time, or you know, could be a one-time lump sum, or it could be distributed over time. These social programs, I think, could they might be similar, but probably less efficient. So as you go through social programs, it might cost a little bit more.
So would it almost look like a basic universal income? Would it look like an annuity? Would it look like, I mean, what like Social Security?
I mean, those are good questions. I like your ideas. We didn't get into the details of how it would look in our report, but you've got good ideas. So it could look like, you know, repeat income tracks. It could look like some type of annuity, and then that one gets over to the idea of Derek Hamilton's idea that he's forwarded with baby bonds, which could have a similar type of result.
But, you know, Jessica, I got a question for you. Why is it so important to close the racial wealth gap between blacks and whites? Why is that an issue? Why is it so important?
Well, wealth has an impact on all areas of your life. So it's the opportunities you have, the opportunities you're able to give to your children, anything from educational opportunities, housing, future employment opportunities, all those things are connected. Wealth also has an impact on things like your health. And so,
yes,
you know, whether or not you like it, in the U.S., we are a society that is very driven by how much money you have.
Yes.
And, you know, so if I were to suddenly have a huge increase in my net worth, I could end up in a different neighborhood that has better schools, that has better job opportunities, that has better health care. And, you know, that would change my life and then my children's lives and so on. And so at a very basic level, you know, unfortunately, your net worth does determine a lot of where you end up.
Yes.
In the United States.
You know, I also like to say that your network can determine your net worth. Again, let me say that again. Your network can determine your net worth. And I'm saying that because even when we look at the educational aspect of it, for me, when I was a young man, getting out of the military, out of the Navy, I started working for McDonnell Douglas. And I'm 25 years old. I'm a quality assurance administrator. I'm making more money than I ever made in my life. And so for me, I became a bigger consumer. And so the more money I made, the more money I spent. And so I was actually making myself, I was becoming more poor the more money that I made until I began to educate myself. And I began to understand the difference between currency and money. I began to understand the difference between currency and credit. I began to understand that money is a tool, that money cannot make you rich. What it can do is it can allow different opportunities that you never had before. You can now contribute to charities, things that you wanted to volunteer that you just didn't have the time to do. Now you can actually write a check and contribute to those ideals that you think that society that will help society. So for me, one of the most important things, it wasn't just the money, it was the education. So John, I mean, what do you think about reparations in a form of education? So that now, I mean, once you receive, you know, certain dollars, a dollar amount, that now you actually, you know what to do with it now versus just, you know, becoming a bigger consumer and giving it right back to the system.
Yeah, I think that's a good question. Tyrone, it's funny. You mentioned that you worked at McDonnell Douglas. I don't know if you know that there's a Rand McDonnell Douglas.
Yes. Yes. Okay. I know the connection.
Rand spun out of the Douglas Aircraft Company.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Sorry. Back to your question. I think it's a good idea. I think there's lots of good ideas in this space. I also would you know, point people to Sandy Darity's discussions, because I think he's had a lot of discussions on reparations.
Wait, say that name again. What was the name again?
Sandy or Williams. He goes by Sandy Darity.
Okay.
Junior. He's had a lot of discussions on these points, so I want to reference him.
Okay.
I do think that people have different reactions to the discussion of reparations, and in a way, you know, we shouldn't, right? This is a story where that we've talked about all the different harms that that Black America has suffered throughout history, even including relatively recent history. So it shouldn't be, you know, that scandalous to discuss redress for those harms. So just agreeing with things you've been saying, Tyrone. And then but to this point of education, I think that's one way that you might get at this. My personal view has been that you actually get a huge amount of information out of the wealth gap itself. So when you think about what today's wealth gap is,
yes,
that is the sum total cost of yesterday's segregation.
Yes.
So I do think we can look at that as that's the value that should be the target of how much Black Americans are owed, and whether or not we are trying to achieve that through grants for college, whether
yes.
or not that's through business loans with favorable terms.
Yes.
Like, you know, it could come through various ways, but I think keeping that guide of the racial wealth gap in mind should be how we are ultimately designing whatever the reparations policy is. That's just my opinion.
Yes. Hey, you know what? And also, I look at the wealth gap as far as, I mean, people look at it like a chasm that you put a bridge over, but I look at it as far as like a track. And like the Indianapolis 500. And I remember when I first got myself together and, you know, I'm looking at, looked at my financial statements and I'm thinking I'm doing pretty good. But the thing is, I was so far behind, you know, I mean, I thought I was doing well, but I was so far behind that I didn't know how far behind I was. I thought I was in first place until I realized that I'd been lapped over 400 times. So, again, with me and having that analogy as far as the wealth gap is more like a track that you've been lapped, because I've heard one study that and I don't know if this is true, but if white people decided to not acquire any more wealth, just decided, you know what, we've got enough, that's going to be it. It would take about 150 years for Black people to even catch up to be at the same level. So, Jessica, I'm going to give you, I mean, because we're running out of time right now, I'm going to give you the last word. And I just want you to express a thought or an idea that you want to share to our audience, just based on your studies, your findings, and what a possible solution, a long-term solution could be to narrow this gap.
Well, I think that we can do things in our everyday lives to try to, think about our own personal wealth or our household's wealth in terms of trying to, you know, get that financial education, take advantage of opportunities, look for a job that has a 401k matching plan, things like that to try to improve your own personal outcomes. But generally, I think we need structural solutions, structural problems. It is really unthinkable, as we sit here talking, that the U.S. has not been forced in any way, shape, or form to compensate African Americans or other people of color for creating the situation. And so I think I hesitate to put too much responsibility on individuals, on African Americans or other groups to solve a problem that we did not create. And that is not saying blame the man, it is just a fact. And so at the end of the day, I think we should not give up. We have agency over our own circumstances, but we should also continue to advocate for serious structural solutions, because it is unfair that we should be starting that race so far behind under other people at no fault of our own.
You know, I think back to when there was a time when Black people could even purchase life insurance, you know, and I'm thinking about this movie, Django Unchained. And there's a scene in the movie where you had this runaway slave and they were Mendigo fighters. And he just, you know, he couldn't fight anymore. So the guy, Leonardo DiCaprio's character, was Mr. Candy. And so they cornered the slave, and he walked to the slave, and he said something profound. He said, "I paid $500 for you, $500, and I expect 500 fights for $500. And so the slave was like, "Yeah, you know, I fought three times." And he said, "Well, yeah, you know, you did, but, you know, I still, you owe me two more fights." And so the issue was that he said, "Well, where am I going to get my $500 from? Are you going to compensate for me, or are we going to reimburse me my $500? Now, in that setting, you know, $500, they kept repeating it over and over and over again. I was asking myself, where did I hear that from? But back then, because we were property, there were certain insurance companies that would actually put life insurance on slaves. And a lot of people don't know this, but they would actually put insurance policies on slaves, and the annual or the average policy was a $500 policy. And so when you get to the end of that scene, what Candy decided to do was release the hounds on this slave, and with the intent of being reimbursed for his $500 for this slave. And so when you look at the systemic, I mean, how did we get here? There's a lot of insurance companies, well-known insurance companies, that used to have slave policies, you know, that would not allow individual Black people to have slaves. And there was this one particular company called, and we're going to cut this short, but there's one individual company called Nautilus Life Insurance Company. And so they decided that they were going to get out of the slave insurance business. And so once they decided to do that, they decided to make that change and stop insuring, putting these life insurance policies on slaves. They decided that they were going to go ahead and change the name of their company. And they changed the name of the company to New York Life. So like you were saying, there's a cause and effect relationship. And it's like, how do we get here? Well, there's a lot of culpability based on the United States and what happened to African-American people. And I don't think until we come to terms with that and the government decides to address this and start making people whole, that we're going to be able to move forward. So I want to thank you, Jessica, for being here today. Jonathan, I want to thank you for being here and for, you know, adding to this discussion. I'm going to give you guys an open invitation to be on Closing the Wealth Gap. You just tell me when. I'll clear my calendar and we'll make sure that you guys back on the show, because this is an ongoing topic. And to me, like I said, it's a national security issue. So whatever information that you guys have and expertise that you want to lend to this conversation, you're more than welcome to be on this show and address your opinions. So, Jessica, thank you. Jonathan,
thank you.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much, Tyrone.
And again, as always, I want people to remember that Tyrone French is Closing the Wealth Gap.
That's our show for this week. Closing the Wealth Gap, the one show, the only show that shows you how to take control of your financial future. Right here in Orange County's only community radio station, OCTalkRadio.net.